Hey, Larry.
Well, hi, Andy.
How are you tonight?
Fantastic.
Well, welcome to episode 12, and we're going to be covering reciprocity law for concealed carry, which is something that the House, the federal House, just voted that says that from the state you're coming from, where you have registered a concealed carry, if you go to another state that has, let's just say that they have more strict laws, that you wouldn't have to know their laws. So that's what the topic's going to be tonight.
So in other words, the state with the most lax carry laws would become, if I got this straight, you could carry your weapon in the state with the most stringent laws. Is that correct?
Yes, and you wouldn't have to follow the strict laws.
Okay. All right. Well, we should have fun with this.
Yes. If you like the podcast and you want to support us, you can visit patreon.com/registrymatters to contribute. Even a dollar would be great. You can also find the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, or Alexa, or your podcast app. If you're finding us from the NARSAW website, welcome. We appreciate you coming over. There is an email notification on the Registry Matters site that will email you as soon as a new episode is posted. An announcement that I have this week is that coming up on next week's episode is we're going to have a guest with us, and that is Emily Horowitz. She recently won the debate with the Soho Reason debate in New York City. We're incredibly excited that she's going to be joining us. Be sure to sign up for notifications or subscribe in your podcast app to get notified as soon as the episode is released. It should come out on the 26th or 27th. Larry, you have an announcement coming up for next week also.
Well, I do. It's on the 28th. NARSAL is launching a new program. Can they do that? And we're going to take questions from listeners and the various states about things that are being required that may be questionable. For example, can they tell me that I must, and you fill in the blanks? And if I don't do that, they'll violate my probation or they'll violate my registration. So we're going to try to take questions and give some general feedback about things that might be over the top and might be worthy of further exploration for an legal action.
Outstanding. What time is that? It's on the 28th. At what time?
We're going to start at 7 Eastern, and we plan to run for 2 hours. So everything we usually build is around Eastern time. So in your various time zone, make the adjustment. But it'll be 7 to 9 Eastern time. And if we have a flood of calls, I'm known to stay longer if the guests are willing to do that. So we could run longer depending on the turnout.
And where do people go to get that information on the call?
Well, I was afraid you were going to ask me that. And since I'm tech challenged, you go to NARSAL.org, and then I think you can help direct them to what they've been switching around to how they can find our podcast and webinars.
At NARSAL.org, and then you can click on, I think it'll be under conferences, get involved, and then conferences. Or get involved, and then calendar. So on the header navigation, there's a get involved and then a calendar, and it should be, yes, it's the first event that comes up there called Can They Do That? And you'll have all the registration instructions and call-in information there.
Yeah, you should be able to link right to the calendar and just plop your name and a small amount of information. We don't ask for much, your name, and you can put in a bogus one. And then your city and state. We like to know where people are around the country so we know what type of reach and exposure we're getting, but that's all that's required.
And there will be a link in the show notes if you find us that way. So you ready to do some news items?
Let's do it.
All right. So this first one comes from the Daily Star. Governor of New York seeks a 1,000-foot boundary for sex offenders around schools. Governor Cuomo wants to increase restrictions for level 2 and 3 offenders to further secure neighborhoods across the state. An attorney opposed to the proposal said that it would leave some people homeless. So here we go with Andrew Cuomo trying to increase the restrictions for, and it says if your victim is age 13 and younger, from traveling or living within 1,000 feet of schools. Can you expand on traveling?
I can't really expand on it because I haven't actually researched the proposal. I've just read the preparation for the podcast. I read the story. So I don't know exactly what they're getting at in terms of traveling, but my guess is that they're trying to have a proximity exclusion where you can't drive or loiter within 1,000 feet of schools. So I'm assuming that's what the traveling means. So they don't want you to be able to live within 1,000 feet of a school or be in the vicinity of the school, which is going to be interesting because sometimes that's the only way to get to a certain destination is to drive past a school. But I'm guessing that's what it means.
And 1,000 feet is a pretty significant difference. I haven't personally experienced this, but you could end up you could almost end up in a situation where you can't get to or from A to B, whether that be to work or your mom's house or whatever.
Well, in a densely populated state like New York, there's of course some more sparsely populated parts, but you've got a lot of dense population centers. So it would render an awful lot of territory off limits in the densely populated urban areas.
And as to the comment about people being homeless, if you make it so that people can't live anywhere and they become homeless, doesn't that make it significantly more challenging for law enforcement to know where you are and or for a person to actually be successful in society?
It does, but this is in response to a Supreme Court ruling in New York. The Supreme Court has declared that local residency restrictions are not permissible, that the state itself is the only entity that can regulate registered sex offenders, that the state law is supreme and that locals can't do it. So the Supreme Court struck down Nassau County's residency restrictions. So this is in response to, well, if we can't do it locally, then we should get it from Albany. So this is the legislators in Albany saying, well, let's have a uniform standard. And so they're proposing to put this on the levels 2s and 3s. Now, just to be clear, these are people who are undergoing a risk assessment. This is not based on offense. New York does have some process. I can't attest to how good it is or how flawed it is, but they do have a process that levels people based on perceived risk. But it's still a tragedy because those people have to live somewhere. And we're going to have, if this becomes law, we're going to have more and more homeless people, which is counterproductive to the stated purpose of public safety. People vanishing is just not, doesn't achieve the desire. If it could, if the registry even worked at all, I don't know how you force people off the grid and figure you're more safe, more secure if you don't know where they are.
This one comes from FoxNews.com. Elected fire chief under attack for conviction. That was 20 years ago, Gilbert told the paper. You know, the story you're telling kids is once you make a mistake, you will be punished for the rest of your life. I've changed my life for the better. Every day I get up and try to do good. Spartanburg mayor who said she and the department have known about Gilbert's status. And there's an update to this one that I think the individual has now stepped down after all of this hoopla about something that he did. And we could argue about whether he did what he did is worthy of a harsher sentence or not. But that's not what happened. He was sentenced. He did his time. He's out. So then the question becomes, should he be allowed to function in society?
Well, according to the critics, he should not. He's forever tarnished, even though he's paid his debt in full. And it's another one of those tragedies because it seems like based on the story, he was elected by the people of the fire department. Did I read that correctly?
Yes.
So, and it seems like as well that the officials of the town knew precisely what his background was and they were willing to forgive him. But from based on the account in the story, it's the victim that's driving this. The mom, parent, I believe, of the victim that's driving this. We can't condone what happened for a very young victim. But what we are saying is that he paid for it in full. He served out every day of what they asked and imposed. And then he said, I've made my amends to society. I want to serve society. And then one of the parents says, we can't let go of it. I'm going to dog you for the rest of your life. And any job you get, what happens now that this has happened, it would inspire that person to follow whatever job he might move to next and make sure that he never can have a life. And to me, it's an example of where the victims have too much power, and this will be a big one for people to criticize about. But the victim should be out of this now because he's paid his debt to society. There's no more role for the victim to play. That chapter of his life is over. But they won't allow it to be over. They're going to go hound these people because they wanted more flesh than what they got, and it'll never be enough for some victims because they don't want the person. They would be happy if the person had been executed. And in fact, if you look at some of the comments, that's what people were asking for.
Absolutely.
Why wasn't he executed?
So on one hand, so that the guy, if the people wanted that to be the punishment for what this guy did, then they should get their politician to make that proposal, get that bill signed in, and that would be the punishment for that crime. But that's not what happened. And we covered this a few episodes back of the representation of the victims and our advocacy work. So this also kind of lends itself to the recent Nassar case where the judge was sort of kind of hinting at some vigilante justice, but we don't have that either.
Well, that's precisely what we're not supposed to have in this country. We pride ourselves on being a rule of law, and the victims and 90% of the cases, or maybe more, I can't quantify it, they can't be objective because they have an emotional stake in what's happened. And victims would want more than what would be fair in most cases. So I don't know what was fair in this case because I didn't sit in the courtroom. I didn't figure out, I don't know enough about the details. But those that were empowered to make those decisions, including the prosecuting attorney, the defense attorney, and the judge, evaluated everything, and they fashioned a sentence that seemed appropriate for his mistakes and transgressions. But now it's not enough. And for this victim, apparently it will never be enough. And that's the tragedy. If we buy into that as a society, that the victim can always hound you, then that's your move back towards vigilantism and mob justice. Who decides what's enough? An orderly society that's ruled by that's governed by the rule of law, decided what the punishment was, and he's paid it. So he should be allowed to go on with his life.
The other piece of this, which would bring up a whole different set of cans of worms, where's the freedom of speech in this?
Were you talking about for her?
Yes.
Well, I mean, she's got the freedom to criticize. She's done it quite eloquently.
Yes, effectively, but, certainly.
Yeah, eloquently and effectively, for that matter. So she's got the freedom to do it. Just because you have the freedom to do something, it doesn't mean it's the right thing to do.
And then through through all of the press that she's gotten, like I said, I'm pretty sure I saw a follow-up. I didn't capture the article, but I think I saw where he stepped down. So her hounding has gotten this dude. He left. Now he probably needs to leave the town for his own safety.
It's what I was saying earlier, that but also that this is reinforced to her that I can dog this person and he'll never hold a productive job. So you can rest assured that wherever he goes, that this is going to be a repeated. She won't say, well, I got him once, I'm satisfied.
Right.
I taught him a lesson. She'll say, I got him once, I can go get him again. And he'll learn that he's never free, and he won't be free. Mm-hmm. And that's what's wrong with the sex offender registry. You can never be free and put it behind you because it's always out there.
I can't say that I've ever seen it for a different kind of crime. Oh, you did X. You should never be allowed to do Y subsequently. This next article.
Well, there are other types of registries, but the sex offender registry is the most draconian in terms of its requirements and in terms of how the registries, but they're not viewed with the same disdain.
Right.
That something about sex offender.
Yeah. This one comes from WA Today, which stands for Western Australia. This one's from Down Under, so it's not directly related to us, but perhaps we have some listeners down under. Anyone found misusing the information, such as sharing it on a vigilante website, will face penalties including a maximum 10-year prison sentence. You can't go around running mob justice, but you can provide information that is common sense that can protect people. So what I'm gathering, kind of like backing my way into it, is that the Australian registry isn't open to the public. And there is this proposal to make certain aspects of it more public. But what I wanted to capture was that if you do go do some kind of vigilante justice based on capturing this information, that there's a prison sentence. So perhaps if we reference back to the previous article, it wasn't exactly vigilante justice, but she did hound the guy to the point that he quit. So our registry doesn't work that way. Our registry is where everybody's information is just out there swinging in the wind. But it looks like Australia has a little bit more of a rational approach to it.
Well, rational for the moment, but opposition right. leader Matthew Guy wants to change that. He yes. said if he's elected in November, that new laws will protect Victorians from the worst of the worst. And this is an example, and we can go off topic just a tad bit to illustrate the point. This is an example of where it's never enough. And I can give you a couple examples in my state where we have a push for Baby Brianna's Law, and child abuse, intentional child abuse resulting in death, carries a potential life sentence if the child is under 12. Well, our current governor is the one who urged the legislature to enact that law many years ago when she was the district attorney from Las Cruces, which is Doñana County. And now she wants to expand upon that to make it a intentional child abuse resulting in death of anyone, any child, all the way up to 18 years of age. So what they do is they get their foot in the door with an incremental. They say, let's do this because these people are defenseless. They're under 12 years old. They can't fight back. So we say, okay, makes sense. Do that. And then they want to come back and heap on, which is what's happening here. If Australia didn't have a registry, the victims' advocates could not be advocating to heap this extra thing on that where they could have information that's currently excluded from the public, because if the information wasn't gathered, it wouldn't be there for to be released to the public. Well, we had the same thing happen when they wanted aggravated criminal sexual penetration of a child. They said, well, we need to have a life sentence for, if you're going to do sexual abuse of a child under 9, then that should be a very heinous crime. Well, it wasn't but 3 years later that they said, well, let's raise the age.
Right.
Let's raise the age to 13. So these things, they're not satisfied, and they will never be satisfied, because there's an industry out there that needs to justify its existence, and they're fighting for DWI. When you look at the laws that the DWI advocates are proposing now, they want to make the limit even lower, because since we're being successful in containing and curbing people's drunk driving habits, in order to keep the funnel coming filled with arrest, we've got to cast a wider net. So this thing, this proposal by the opposition in Australia, is an example of the information shouldn't be there to begin with, but at least for the moment, it's private. Well, if Matthew Guy gets elected, and if he carries through on his platform, which I'm sure he would, that could easily change. The other side of the question you had was about the penalty. That's a horrendous penalty for misusing the information. But I might point out that many of our states have similar statutes. They don't call for such a harsh penalty, but I have yet to find a registered citizen who's ever been able to have a successful prosecution or even a thorough investigation of anything where they've been harassed, or whether they've been physically attacked, or whatever, misuse of registry information. I would challenge our thousands of listeners, if you know of a successful attempt prosecution, even if it failed, please send that to us, because I've just, theoretically, many states could prosecute people misusing registry information, and I'm not aware of it ever happening.
Yeah, I guess another way to word that is murder is still illegal, even if you're on the registry, or other kinds of assault or whatever. Those are still illegal, but we know that they happen.
We know that they happen, and what they typically do is say, well, we can't draw a direct connection. It's only when the person proclaims that they're doing it because of the person's registry status that kind of contains law enforcement, and they have to grudgingly say that the registry, but they don't make that concession very often unless there's a proclamation. They don't investigate anything and say, yep, we found that the registry is the link here that caused this crime. I'm not aware of it. I'm not aware of any prosecution. And I want to give law enforcement credit. If they are prosecuting these cases, we'd love to know about them.
Certainly. This final article comes from KATU.com. ACLU questions new, and this is Oregon State University policy requiring students to disclose past felony convictions. The policy requires all continuing and future students to self-disclose any felony convictions, whether they're a registered sex offender, before they enroll. So how are you ever supposed to move on, Larry, if you you have to tell everybody and their cousin about your past?
Well, obviously, that's an impediment, but what about those people that are trying to run a safe educational environment that are going to be slapped with a lawsuit that are admitting these students without doing any due diligence whatsoever? What gives here? What responsibility do they have for the safety of the faculty and the other students of the university?
Can't they just run a normal background check?
Well, isn't that what they're proposing? The law requires all future students to self-disclose any felony. whether or not they're a registered sex offender before they enroll.
Right.
So and whether they're registered.
Right. So they're saying that when I enroll, I have to tell them I am. Whether they do the background check or not is a different story.
So,
a lot of minors, they have sealed records. So I guess the idea then is that if you were a minor when you committed that kind of crime, that you're able to, as an adult, turn that chapter and move on.
Well, I see that consideration there. So anything that would have been a closed record would now be an open record if you had to disclose that. And I think that comes from the baseball guy that had that was a player up there that had,
that's right.
So that was a high profile case where the university did everything they could to support him. But it wasn't enough because he shouldn't have been allowed to play, as far as the detractors said.
Right. The victim's advocates went after that guy with a vengeance.
I don't even know if he's still on the squad or not. I don't know how that ultimately resolved itself, but I know that the university and the students were behind his teammates, were behind him. But I'm not surprised when you have a high profile case like that, that this would be a reaction that would be a law proposed. Oregon is an interesting place in terms of their legislature. I'm not going to pronounce it a slam dunk, but a high profile makes it likely that something will be done.
I just had something I wanted to bring up. Damn it. And now I don't remember what it was. Oh, so what about, where does the balance fall in, should the schools be in charge of the investigation and prosecution of someone doing some sort of assault versus the criminal justice system? I've heard it argued if the school handles it and they keep it in-house, then they can deal with it, squash it, and the person doesn't end up with a record. But on the flip side, they're not necessarily qualified to handle that, and we have a judicial system to handle that. Going that route, though, you end up kind of like with the whole teacher situation in Connecticut, where you might saddle someone that did something inappropriate, perhaps crosses some legal boundaries, but, you know, you just riddle their lives, you send them down the tubes.
You've got parallel processes that can be at work, could be in operation simultaneously, because the university has one set of considerations. Most universities, flagship and large universities, do have a law enforcement agency on campus, so crimes that occur on campus can be investigated by the campus police, by the university police. But you've got the issue of whether the student's attendance is appropriate based on the initial investigation of what we're having happen there's tremendous pressure to put on the university to go ahead and jettison these people when the mere accusation is made. Is that sufficient to go ahead and expel them and suspend them as their academic standing from the university? So that's one part of the consideration where the process is collapsing as we watch. There's very little process, and not much of it is giving the person a chance to respond in a confrontational fashion to determine if they should remain enrolled. And then you've got the criminal process that normally is going to take place and the judicial district of the state where the offense is alleged to have occurred, if there's enough probable cause to put that forward. But when you have a campus police department where there's federal dollars at stake, that campus police department is really striving hard to close the file with a referral for a prosecution, because the universities have taken a lot of grief for not finding that these cases are substantiated. So as the pendulum swung the other direction, you're getting a lot of pressure to refer these for prosecution. And then the district attorney or the prosecutor or whatever it may be called in your jurisdiction is facing, what do I do with this hot potato now? The police have given it to me and say they recommend prosecution. What am I supposed to do? So we have some prosecutions that are going forward that are probably not the strongest cases that you could imagine seeing. And I think you could relate to most everybody for the Duke lacrosse case just a few years ago.
Right.
As a high profile case that was a garbage case, but there was an immense pressure to seek justice for the victims, and there was no justice to be sought because nothing had been done.
Right. So I'm not sure that I got the answer. I know that there are parallel processes, and just one way seems that it could be not enough, and the other way seems like it could be too much.
Well, I'm saying that the universities are not giving the due process that we would think, I would think, is, in my opinion, is robust enough.
Correct. That's where I'm going with that.
In terms of the student status, but the university can't convict the person. They can only find that there's sufficient grounds to expel them. But it doesn't take much. I mean, we've got people that are resigning from their offices, and whether it be in the private sector or the public sector, based on accusations that are decades old with very little supporting evidence. They're
right.
being forced out. So the universities are doing the same thing. They're forcing students out with very little evidence. I mean, a person's accusation is evidence. I want to be clear on that. That is evidence. But that alone, not enough in most cases, because there are reasons why people can make false claims.
Right.
So generally, you would hope that there'd be some corroboration of some kind through forensics evidence or through another witness that saw something or heard something. But we're getting to the point where the universities are saying that just an accusation is enough. We're gonna expel you. So that I think is problematic. And then they hit, like I say, that if the police agency of the university hands off the case, they're handing off cases that 5 years ago would not have been deemed prosecutable. But now they're under pressure to go forward with the prosecution. We need to try to indict this. So they're handing off cases and say, we recommend prosecution. Somebody gets stuck with a hot potato. So when you hand the hot potato off to the district attorney, in most cases, they're elected. In most cases, most states in this country, we elect the prosecutors at the state level. Federally, they're appointed by the president, but in the state systems, more states elect them. So you hand it off to a person who's elected directly by the people. That's a hot potato for them too.
Yeah.
So they have to prosecute.
Does this move back into some terms that we've covered before, like rational basis and probable cause? Does this tie into those terms at all?
It does. Probable cause is a standard that's subjective, whether there's enough. That's what is required for a prosecution to move forward. And probable cause is not an extremely high standard, but it's a standard. It's a standard that a crime has been committed, so you need to have enough evidence to show that a crime has been committed. And that's where the victim comes in, because the victim says, well, of course a crime is committed. I said there was. But think about that, because that's the first prong. And then there has to be enough evidence on the probable cause standard to show that the person that you want to indict and have stand trial is probably the one that did it. Not beyond a reasonable doubt, but probably when the case unfolds, the evidence will be strong enough to show that this person is guilty of that offense. So you have to have an offense, and you have to have enough evidence to suggest that they probably did it. Well, probable cause is now, suppose you called up and you had an internal embezzlement, and you just said, well, take my word for it. I'm missing $116,000 over the last year and a half. And they say, well, show us how you know. Well, don't worry about it. I said I'm missing $116,000. We would never let that fly.
Right.
We would say, well, we want to see how you documented your loss of $116,000. And there would be a comment that will come in and say, well, Larry, are you comparing an embezzlement with a sex offense? Well, in a way I am, because we're potentially taking someone's freedom away for a long period of time, and someone saying that they did something is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It barely is enough to establish that there was in fact a crime occurred. Why do you think they go in when you call and say we had a robbery? Well, in the old days they would send out a graphic artist to make a sketch, but now they say, let's get your surveillance tape. What do you think they would say if you said, well, we don't have any, we erased it all?
They wouldn't even investigate it beyond that then.
Yeah, they would look at you like, well, why did you do that? Well, you take my word for it. They'd say, well, is this an inside job possibly? But see, when it comes to a sex offense, you're never supposed to doubt or question. And that defies the confrontation clause. You're supposed to be able to confront the accuser. That's one of the primary foundational aspects of our system is confrontation. It's not supposed to be easy to take a person's freedom away.
So if
but
I can,
we have the victim. The victim's advocate saying that you should just be able to do it because we say so. But go ahead.
Right. So the way that I'm looking at this is from, like, in computer terms, where the The crime should be kind of something abstract. Let's see if I can work my way through this. In that there is a varying degree of severity of crime, but the crime itself is anonymous, let's say. Whereas crime A could be is one thing and crime B is a thing. And we could interchange them. So then you have the perpetrator and the victim, and all three pieces could be swapped out, and they should be looked at with a similar degree of scrutiny. So in the case that you just gave of the embezzlement, not to diminish like an actual victim-oriented crime, but and the way that we deal with that is that there's a punishment side of it, in that an embezzlement doesn't carry the same kind of punishment that a victim-oriented crime does. But all of them should follow the same sort of path down from start to end, where you have a crime and you can fill in the blank of what the crime is. But the evidentiary process should be the same all the way through. And you're saying that if you won't accept, I say they stole the money, then you shouldn't accept he touched my hoo-hoo. They should carry the same level, the burden of proof, correct?
That's what I'm saying, and I expect I'll get a lot of criticism for that. But taking a person's free, the state, when we're talking about the state, we're talking about the government, and I'll just use that. A state or the federal prosecutors, they have enormous, fathers recognize that the state will always have more power than most individuals. So they built a foundation that says it's going to be difficult for the state to deprive a person of their life, liberty, and their freedom. So it is supposed to be hard to convict a person. So when we investigate crimes, the first step is to determine if there's evidence that a crime actually occurred. You don't get to the second prong of probable cause without identifying that a crime has occurred. And there has to be evidence of a crime. If you call and say you had your home burglarized and they see no signs of forcible entry, and you can't, you get a very weird look from a detective. When you say, well, what's missing? You give them a list of things that's missing. And they say, well, how did they get it? Well, I left the door open. Oh, you left the door open. That investigation problem is not going to go very far either. But there has to be evidence of criminality that can be verified. And that's what's beginning to go lacking when it comes to particular sex offenses, but not just sex offenses. But we're to secure more convictions, we want to make it easier and easier for the government to secure convictions.
Right.
To the detriment of our Constitution.
And that even ties into statute of limitations then too.
Correct. It certainly does. If you have no statute of limitations, then no one's ever beyond the zone of prosecution. The more years that pass, the more difficult it is for you to have anything favorable to your side, because it's all vanished. Your people are all dead. I mean, we've gone through this in a previous podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I like to take things to a logical extreme. So my granddad said that your family did something to mine. So you guys are going to be taken to court over something my granddad said that you did. Well, you know, my granddad died 40 years ago, and now there's no statute of limitations. So let's run it.
I don't see a problem with it.
Awesome. So we did receive a comment from episode 11 on residency restrictions, and Allie writes, I don't believe looking at a picture should be considered a sex offense. I'd like to know how anyone can sexually abuse a picture. I remember the movie Blue Lagoon. Brooke Shields was 14 at the time. They showed her naked in the movie, not to mention the little baby in the water was totally naked. I guess if we watch that movie, we're all sex offenders. I was married to a 21-year-old man when I was 16. My parents gave us their blessing. I guess my husband was a sex abuser. Yeah, I'm kind of with Allie on that one, and especially the Brooke Shields thing. That was a crazy popular movie, and she was a minor at the time, and there was some body parts showing in that movie.
Aha. Uh-huh. I don't recall that. Maybe I missed that particular scene. But I thought I saw Blue Lagoon.
It's a pretty old movie, early 80s, late 70s.
Yep, Well, the argument goes, Allie, that the person wanting to look at the pictures generates the demand for the production of the images. So therefore, in order to contain demand, you have to go after the end user. And the end user is what generates the demand. So although you can't abuse the picture, the production of the picture is abusive of the child. So it's a demand, it's a suppressor of demand philosophy here, and there's some logic in that, but the extreme penalties is what we question. But that's the theory, is that the you don't abuse the picture, but you abuse the child in creating the picture.
Thank you so very much, Ali, for the comment. If you'd like to talk to us, Larry, how can those people reach us?
Well, I don't know how Ali reached us, but I'm glad she did. But there's a number of ways to reach us here. And you can send us an email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. So that's registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Or you can visit us at registrymatters.co, or you can call us. And the telephone number, even with our extra digit here, is 747-227-4477.
Thank you for
pointing that. That's 747-227-4477. We will endeavor to respond to you either by a phone call or mentioning you on the podcast until they get so voluminous that we can't.
All right, so on to the topic for tonight about reciprocity laws. And we definitely have an ulterior motive for bringing this one up. But so the story goes, in early December, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill that is one of the National Rifle Association's highest priorities, which seems to go against the interests of the voters. Each state has their own concealed carry gun laws. It is on the owner of the gun to know the laws of the state they're traveling to make sure that they're in compliance with the local laws. A state such as Maryland, which has restrictions on where a person can carry, would be required to follow the laws of a state like Utah, which grants permits without any safety training, even to out-of-state residents. The crazy thing about how I read that is, me down here in the Southeast, I could possibly go to Utah and get a concealed carry permit with nothing more than just some basic documentation, and then I would be able to go to Maryland and follow the concealed carry laws from Utah, even though I live in a different state?
Well, what they're actually doing is trying to make the permit issued in any state valid in all states. So this is pending in the Senate now. This is a House resolution that's already passed the House and is sitting in the U.S. Senate. And if it were to pass the Senate, it would receive President Trump's signature without any hesitation, in my opinion. So what's happening is that if you are able to secure a permit, regardless of how lax the standards are, and our state is kind of in the middle here in terms of standards, we do require some proficiency demonstration, and you can't have a criminal record to receive a concealed carry permit. But there are states where they don't require any proficiency training in the use of a firearm, so you would be able to take that permit, and if you were to encounter a law enforcement officer in the strict state, that permit would have to be recognized as being valid. And so you would in essence take state control away from the states that have more stringent standards, because they would be obligated to recognize a permit issued anywhere. And it's interesting to me that the proponents of this are the people who believe, or so they claim, to be staunch supporters of states' rights. And they say that the states are better equipped than Washington, D.C. is to determine what's best for each individual state. And they preach that about Medicaid, about welfare benefits, about TANF. We should let the states run these programs. They can tailor systems that meet the needs of their citizens. And we shouldn't dictate from D.C. how the states make their decisions, because they're better equipped. And then magic, when it comes to something like this, they're none too hesitant to say, well, now we're going to forget that we have that policy and that philosophy about us, and we hope that you guys as voters don't remember it, but we're going to nullify the will of the people that have strict gun laws, and we're going to say that you have to recognize these, because we in Washington, we know best, and by golly, that's the way it ought to be. It's an interesting hypocritical stand, but it's kind of common. Both sides tend to be hypocritical from time to time, but I notice a lot more of it on the conservative side, and they're not intellectually honest. When you point them out, they will justify. When you call them out on this, they will find some rational justification. But from our point of view, as the people on the registry, we ought to use this to our advantage. We ought to say, yes, we can kind of see where you're coming from. because they found some poster child that traveled into New Jersey where they have strict laws. And I think she was in Pennsylvania, which was the impetus for the legislation. And she did not know about the strict New Jersey laws. And she got prosecuted in New Jersey for violating their gun laws. But for a pardon from Governor Christie, facing incarceration for violating the laws, but yet she had a permit in Pennsylvania. So that was the impetus. But we could make the same argument. We could say, well, now, Mr. Conservative, since you say that it's too onerous for people to do all this research and be abreast of what's required, why is it that when I'm registered in Pennsylvania and I happen to go to Florida, I have to learn all this stuff all over again because their laws are different? Why don't you require Florida to honor Pennsylvania? Why don't we have the Sex Offender Reciprocity Act and see what that conservative says and see how quick they twist into a pretzel and do backflips and cartwheels to explain why the sex offender registry is different and why that argument doesn't apply?
Because we have to save one child.
Well, we're not saying they shouldn't have to register. We're saying that they shouldn't be responsible for knowing the nuances of the state they travel to, just like the lady who traveled from Pennsylvania to New Jersey. That was too much of a burden on her. She got caught up in a system and got prosecuted, but she didn't mean bad. She was complying. So we got the same thing. We've got a registrant in Pennsylvania who travels to Alabama. He or she's diligently complying in Pennsylvania. And as long as they do what's required in Pennsylvania, they shouldn't have to know all the nuances of Alabama's law, because there's 50 states out there. Is it reasonable to expect a person on the registry to be able to keep 50 state laws sorted out? It's the exact same argument.
Let's see. So your driver's license would carry state to state. You've been issued a driver's license in state A, and that is valid in another state as long as you're not sticking around. But what about different driving laws? Those are pretty standardized, aren't they? I'm trying to come up with another example that would be more applicable to most people.
Well, the states have agreed to recognize the driver's license reciprocity. It wasn't a mandate by the federal government. So that's one big difference.
Okay.
States enter into agreements. So that's what you have with the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. So the states have agreed, and they can do that. But this is the big old bad government who believes in states' rights. This is the people in Washington that tell us how the states know best and elect me, and I'll get the federal government off the states' backs, because by golly, they don't need Washington dictating everything. That's my objection to it. The hypocrisy of this. Mr. McConnell, you're a hypocrite. Ryan, you're a hypocrite.
In my research, and this came from a whole slew of websites, they were saying that the vast majority of people do not support this. This is totally being driven by the NRA.
I would find that hard to believe. The gun-toting people would be very much in favor of this. So I don't know where those statistics were coming from. And Americans are very much a gun-toting society. We have
Certainly.
Over 100 million guns. At last estimate, over 100 million, maybe even more. But maybe it's 300 million. I mean, and of course, we're surprised that we have the largest number of gun deaths, but that's a discussion for another episode sometime.
It's not related.
So,
but okay, so then in Congress, in them passing this law, I was also reading that this clearly violates the 10th Amendment, making it unconstitutional. It would just immediately get challenged. And I can see that many states would then bring this up saying, hey, what about our 10th Amendment states' rights? And you guys are pushing this down our throat. So isn't Congress responsible for knowing if a law is constitutional or not before they throw it down the path?
Well, ideally, they would take that into consideration. But the courts ultimately decide that, and it's presumed constitutional upon enactment until a challenging party steps forward and says, we disagree. I would anticipate that states that have more stringent laws would step forward and say that we don't want to relax our laws to match Mississippi or Arizona or whatever, and I suspect there'd be challenges. With the way the courts are being packed these days with conservatives, I don't know what they would say. We'll have to wait and see when the challenge comes, if it makes it past the Senate and to the president's desk, because I have no doubt he would probably sign this.
Certainly. So is this, in your opinion, is this an overreach of the federal government over the states, or should they be doing this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's absolutely an overreach, but they don't learn from their overreaches. The reason why we have same-sex marriage universally now is because of that overreach, and they didn't learn a thing from that. The reason why we have same-sex marriage, the law of the land, is because the people who proclaim that they believe in states' rights did not want to recognize, I believe it was New York State, that had back in the 90s, they when Clinton put in the military, don't ask, don't tell policy. The conservatives saw that as the beginning of the end. They said that next thing you know, we're going to have all sorts of homosexual stuff. So they passed the Defense of Marriage Act that defined federally for receiving federal benefits and being recognized as a valid marriage, it had to be between a man and a woman. Till then, the states had always decided what marriages, how they would recognize who could get married, what constituted a valid marriage. So when they passed the Defense of Marriage Act, states that recognized same-sex marriage, when the person went in to collect federal benefits, they were not able to get the federal benefits because they cited DOMA, which was federal law. They said, we can't give you this federal benefit, even though that's a valid marriage, because DOMA says we can't do that and we have to abide by the law of the land. So challengers in New York, a person died, if I believe it right, in New York that was entitled to a pension, and they were legally married, and I think it was two women. Mm-hmm. One of them, the surviving spouse, challenged that and said, I want my money. And that's how we ended up with this going to the Supreme Court. And the Obama administration said, we're not even going to fight this any longer. We're not going to try to keep defending DOMA because the circuit court has said it's unconstitutional. And conservative members of Congress raised the money themselves, and they figured out a way to fund it, and they went to the Supreme Court. So it would have just been a circuit court decision binding in that circuit, but they wanted a Supreme Court determination, and they got it. So it ties together in this same thing because they don't learn from their mistakes, and they keep doing the same thing again. That was an overreach. If they had not tried to meddle with marriage, we would have some states that would be issuing same-sex marriages, and we'd have an awful lot of states that are very conservative that would not be doing them, like for remember the clerk in Tennessee that got thrown yes. in jail because after the Supreme Court said that she said, I ain't going to issue no damn marriage certificate. That defies my religious belief. There'd be a lot of these conservative states that would not have same-sex marriage today but for the overreach. And they couldn't help themselves, and they can't help themselves, and they won't be able to help themselves, and they'll continue to do this. And I don't know how this is going to play out, but I think it's an overreach, but it'll have to play itself out because they will not self-contain.
I got a clip, a quote from an attorney, and I'm hoping you can help unpack it. It says, core principles of federalism dictate that Congress may not force state governments to absorb the financial burden of implementing regulatory decisions made by other states. But that's just what would happen under the NRA's proposal.
Well, I don't know exactly what he means, but I would imagine that I understand federalism and that the separation of the what's not specifically the powers are not specifically dedicated for Congress for the federal government or reserved for the state. So I get that part, but I'm not sure what the regulatory burden would be of this, because if you have reciprocity, what would be the enhanced regulatory if you go into a state like New York that's much stricter than Arizona? What would New York have to, since they have to recognize it on its face, what would the regulatory hurdle be for them?
I'm thinking the situation would be that they would have to you would be identified as a person not following their laws. They would then have to turn around and do the research of that state's laws to determine if you are in compliance with those laws, just kind of gumming up their system, I guess.
Well, if you're possessing the permit, wouldn't that suggest that you're in compliance? If the state of Arizona issued your permit and you show an officer that you're, when you pulled over, and he says, do you have any weapons in the car? And you say, I sure do. And you hand him the permit. Wouldn't that demonstrate you're in compliance?
Suppose you go into, and I'm not really clear on this, but let's say you go into like on a college campus in a more strict state from a more lenient state, and now you're not in compliance with those local laws and you get busted for being carrying on that place. That would initiate what I just described, wouldn't it?
Well, now that brings in a twist I hadn't even thought about, because I thought that the permit would still, it would be valid, but I didn't know it would give you rights. The proposal would give you rights to carry in places that were precluded.
I guess, you know, that's part of the interpretation of it. But if you come from a state where you can carry just anywhere within the state borders, and now you go to a state where you can't just carry anywhere, whether that be restaurants or churches or colleges, you could get jammed up now.
Yeah, I had not thought about that aspect. So that would certainly be a nightmare to figure out if you if you were carrying legitimately, if it's going to force the state to allow you to carry in places that's precluded in that state. That's great. That really is respecting states' rights. I tell you, I have to give the Republicans credit on this one.
And we already covered it, but I just want to make sure the reason why we're covering this is not to go after any. I don't particularly care about the gun law thing. It's a non-issue. It's an issue. I don't particularly care. But the reason why we're bringing this up is because of the registry, that if you are on the registry and you try and travel to a state in the South, particularly like Florida or Alabama, they have crazy strict rules. And if you come from a place where it's not that big of a deal, you go step foot in those territories and you are going to get messed up bad. And if we would follow this argument, then the laws of where you've come from would be the laws that you would have to follow no matter where you went in the United States. So we're just bringing up the hypocrisy of it and just, hey, look, if you're going to do something, be consistent, pick a team, but be consistent with it.
That's one of the things that we try to, on this whole podcast, we're trying to provoke intellectual thought, because we all can be hypocrites if we're not challenged in our thought processes. And it's easy to fall into that, because if you're not being provoked to think through your own position, it's easy to not do so. So we're trying to provoke thought here. And I tell people, for example, I'm for preemption of local restrictions, and we succeeded in getting that in our state statute here. Locals can't, communities cannot impose anything, but magically, local communities that have higher minimum wage laws that they've enacted, particularly through a referendum process, if they voted on it by the citizens, magically, I don't find any reason to preempt that. I'm being a little bit of a hypocrite here, because the conservatives would come back and say, well, of course we should preempt cities from having higher minimum wage. It makes it difficult for us to attract business to the state. They don't know what the rules change from city to city and county to county. Why shouldn't we have preemption and uniformity like what you said for SORNA? I'm in a hypocritical position, aren't I? Acknowledge it. A lot of our listeners won't. And that's what we're trying to do, is provoke that thought. I'm in a hypocritical position about preemption, because I'm for it, except for when it doesn't suit my purposes.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, we could go on for hours about this whole gun debate, too. That's a different subject.
That's one where the conservatives are chronic hypocrites. When you let a local community enact a higher minimum wage, and they do their best, if the conservatives control that state assembly, they will pass a law preempting that. They did it in Missouri, in St. Louis. The Missouri legislature came in and said, I don't care what you people did in St. Louis. We're going to roll your, they actually, people took pay cuts over there because they rolled the minimum wage back to the state level, and they did it by preemption. But those are the people who claim that local government's closer to the people, more responsive to the people, and that we should defer decisions to local as much as possible, except for those decisions that we don't agree with.
Well, yeah, that's always how it goes.
Hypocrisy at its finest. And I'm calling them out on that. If you truly believe that local decision making is so good and that they're closer to the people, then why would you enact laws to preempt what the decisions local people have made? But that's a double-edged sword, because if we invite that, then we have to be willing to have locals make decisions on things that we don't like, and we magically are against that.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah, I'm all about trying to take away as many of the personal element to it and move it into something else that isn't so personal. Like in this case, if you are a super duper gun advocate and you're like, well, damn, yeah, we should be able to carry across state lines. Okay, we'll switch that to a different subject and see if you have the same passion for it. Just be
Absolutely.
Fair. Just be fair.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just like the people who believe in the religious freedom to decline people on services. I asked them, are you going to be okay with that? Because I see your logic. A person shouldn't have to provide a service contrary to the religious belief. But the courts have held that public accommodations are open to everybody. So are you going to be okay if a person says, I won't rent to you because you're an unescorted woman, you don't have a man with you? Are you going to be okay when you're driving after 8 hours when they say my religious beliefs don't do that, will allow me to do that? And if you're consistent with that, I'll accept that. But most of you won't be consistent. You'll say, well, that's different.
Of course it
because
is.
Because it's a non-Christian. And that's the only difference in it. Because there's no Christian belief that I'm aware of. If it is, it's a very, very
fringe
sliver of the fringes of Christianity, but they would be some Middle Eastern religions that would be very, very common, where an unescorted woman couldn't get ride in a taxi cab, they couldn't rent a hotel room. There's a lot of things, and if they say that's my religious belief, you would not stand for that in the United States of America.
So First Amendment.
The hell with your religious. So if you're going to be intellectually honest, you cannot allow a person to decline service based on religious belief. If you can't accept that, then you're being intellectually dishonest.
First Amendment, Larry.
What about the First Amendment?
Well, my religious freedom. I can act upon it however I want.
You can practice it, but you can't. You cannot. The courts decided a long time ago. Services. When you open your doors, you have to provide services to people who want to patronize you. So if it's deemed a public accommodation, you got to provide the service. Now, how far that goes, if it goes to baking cakes, and how far a public accommodation, but you can't decline people based on religious beliefs. Yeah, you do that in your synagogue and your church.
Right.
but it doesn't belong in a place of business where you're serving the public.
Certainly, I like it. This is a good one. Is there anything else you want to go over?
I think I'm good, unless we didn't cover anything.
I think we covered it all. I came across a really good quote, and it relates to, it was either last episode or the episode before, about doing something versus nothing. And the comment was made about hiring legal professionals or getting them for free. But so here's the quote. I learned that most problems aren't rocket science. But when they are rocket science, you should ask a rocket scientist. And that's from astronaut Scott Kelly. And it rings true, because if you want to get into legal stuff or lobbying, whatever, you should probably work with someone that has done it before and not try and go at it on your own.
That would be one piece of advice I would give you. And then if you are determined to do it on your own, don't be angry at the way the system works. Don't come in with an attitude that it ought not be this way, because the world is the way it is be, not the way you want it to be. So when you go into the sausage making factory, don't be angry how they make the sausage. If you're gonna come in that building and you want to participate in that process, they have traditions that have gone back a long time, and this is just the way things are, and you're gonna have to learn how to work within the system. And you may not like it, but you need to learn figure out how the system operates. And people come in, if they're not a rocket scientist, I can understand, but you need to at least learn how the system works and appreciate their traditions and how things work, how things orderly proceed through the process. And there's a system of how they do things.
Absolutely. Larry, very enjoyable hour. I appreciate it very, very much. And I'll talk to you soon. Good night.
It's always my pleasure, Andy. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Have a question? Send an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com or leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website, registrymatters.co. This is episode 12. Music is Downtown by bensound.com. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We would appreciate it if you did. And thanks for listening.